morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. The show is also podcasting. We are on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to this show on iTunes. We are now in our last opera program. It is the fifth one. We've been here 5 weeks, 5 Mondays, talking to Desiree Mays. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which is written every year to accompany the Santa Fe opera season. Welcome, Desiree.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
So many operas, 5 operas a year. And the last one that we're going to talk about is Mozart's Così fan tutte, which is, well, we do a Mozart opera every year at the Santa Fe Opera.
Pretty much, yes. That's been a tradition right from the beginning that John Crosby started, and we are more or less still doing it. Mozart is great. I mean, you can never have enough Mozart.
And there's a lot of Mozart operas.
Yes and no. I mean, he didn't write anything like the number Donizetti, for instance, because he died at the age of 35. It's mind-boggling to think what might have happened if that man had lived beyond 35 years of age.
It is indeed. We'd have new alternative energy sources and all sorts of things.
Who knows?
The whole world would be different if Mozart had lived to be 70.
You know that Mozart is played, I understand, at any given minute of the hour of any of the 24 hours of every day he is being played somewhere on this planet. Is that amazing?
I'm sure that's true.
And this
true.
Man died penniless. The tragedy of that in and of itself is amazing.
So Così fan tutte, that's Italian, and it means basically all the ladies are doing it. All the ladies do that.
That's right. Or typically it's translated as women are like that, which has always raised people's hackles, especially women's hackles from day one. It's a very unfortunate title in a sense. And if Mozart and his librettist Lorenzo da Ponte had changed the E at the end of tutte to I, it would have meant all people, men and women, and then it would have been fine. So,
right, right.
So is this an opera that's having a little dig at women, that women are not faithful or constant, all of those things, or is it Mozart maybe just saying that women are unpredictable, they're mysterious, and it's not quite clear what will happen next when you're involved with them?
No, it's quite clearly saying that women are unfaithful, which is rather the pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah, well, Despina, who's one of the characters in the opera, gets her own back of that. And in fact, some of the opera companies over time who've been trying to come to terms with this unfortunate title have given it other names. So it was The Tables Turned in an English production, or Tit for Tat, and then they took it to another country and called it something else. So they've been trying to get around it, and it's always a small bone of contention. And personally, I think, as we get into the opera, we'll see, Mozart loved women, and Mozart was one of the most forgiving human beings on earth. He was very compassionate. He could set up a dramatic conflict and an argument and resolve it, but he would never be judgmental in terms of how this argument would come out or conflict.
And in his personal life or in his dramas?
In his dramas, specifically. Personal life is always a little hard. I try to keep those separate, Mary Charlotte, because the man and his music are often appear to be two different things. They're not, of course.
Indeed.
I mean, they're so totally bound together. Wagner is a good example. And Mozart, I mean, was as scatty as he was portrayed in the opera Amadeus. And yet this God-given music comes out of this rather strange little man.
Well, let's talk about the plot so that people who are listening now saying, women are unfaithful, what on earth are you talking about?
Well, this was an interesting how this opera came about. Normally, the court of the time would commission a composer who was typically on staff to write an opera. In this case, the Emperor Joseph, who was in Vienna, had heard of a scandal that was going around Vienna at the time about two couples who had changed partners, who had swapped partners. And he was mildly amused by this. So the story and maybe the rumor goes that he asked Mozart and Lorenzo da Ponte, the librettist, if they would write a little opera on this little subject. So it's a very little story. It's got a lot of implications, as we'll see as we get into it. But that apparently was the idea. And Mozart, who did as the emperor commanded, said, sure, he would write an opera. But he was a genius at taking something that simple and turning it into something much greater. It turns out there was a Greek source, as there always is. You know, the Greeks said it all. I mean, there are only a few stories.
So why do we even bother?
Well, if you trace any story today in Greek or Roman mythology, most of them will go back, the great quest of the hero, you know, saving the maiden in distress, fighting the dragons. It's all about quests. We're still questing. We all do that, no matter what we call it, whether life is an adventure or what. Now, in this case, apparently, the the closest one can come, I think, in terms of myth, is the story of Cephalus and Procris. They are wildly in love, and then the husband is one of those jealous types, and he wonders what would happen if another man approached his wife. So he disguises himself as another man and approaches her, and of course it leads to guaranteed chaos. And that, again, is a little germ that feeds the story of Così fan tutte. Lorenzo da Ponte was very happy to go with this. I mean, he loved rumor and was in the middle of all the scandals of Vienna at the time, had numerous lady loves, one of whom is featured in this opera, as it turns out, who was also, it was rumored, involved in a partner-swapping scandal. This is nothing new. And so maybe some of her expertise or experience got written into the opera. The opera starts, and we should play a little music, and it starts rather unusually for the time period. This is, we're talking about the classical period of music, which is Mozart, with a series of trios with three men. There are two young officers, Ferrando and Guglielmo, who are engaged to these two sisters, and their friend, an older man, their mentor, whatever you call him, they get together and they sing a series of trios. It's rather unusual. And the boys are saying how great their fiancés are. And he's skeptical. He says, are these women goddesses or women? No more, no less. And he devises a little plan to test the girls' fidelity. And the plan is that he will go to the girls and tell them that their officers have been called away to war, and there's a terribly tragic farewell scene, and then 10 minutes later the two officers come back disguised as exotic characters. In the original, they're Albanians, so that the girls would not recognize who they were. So this is the sort of the plot and the idea, the wager that is made. Don Alfonso tells Ferrando and Guglielmo, proposes that he will pay 100 guineas if the girls are unfaithful. And they're only too delighted to take on the wager because they plan how they're going to spend it. They're going to have a big party. They know they're going to win. There's no question the girls will remain faithful. So the first piece I'd like to play
There's
for
no
you.
Question in the mind of the two fiancés, but the older friend of theirs doesn't believe for a moment that they'll remain faithful.
Yeah, he's a real skeptic, and he doesn't think...
And cynical.
And cynical, and maybe just bored. I mean, they're all on the shores of Napoli in this lovely villa. They don't have a lot to do. There's a lot going on here, too, because this opera was written in 1790 when the French Revolution was at its height, just over the border in France. And the setting, I think, is deliberate, of Naples with an image of Vesuvius erupting in the background. But they pay no attention to that. These young people are in love, and it doesn't matter. So the wager is made, and Don Alfonso goes to the two girls, and he tells them this. The fiancés are going off to the war, and there's a tragic farewell that's really a parody. And then when the boys have gone, there's this absolutely gorgeous trio. Soave sia il vento, gently blows the wind, as they stand on the beach waving goodbye to the ship that's taking the two young officers away, Don Alfonso and the two girls. And I think at this point in the music, Mozart steps out of character, has his characters step out of character, and just sings something straight from the heart that is so beautiful. It's a trio of farewell and all of their concern and sadness at the boys leaving, not knowing if they're going to come back.
Hey!
the trio from Così fan tutte by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The recording we're playing today is a 1962 live recording with the Vienna Philharmonic with Karl Böhm conducting. So we've met the two officers, Ferrando and Guglielmo, the tenor and the baritone, and Don Alfonso, who is their older friend. And then we have the two girls. They're introduced separately in a duet, Fiordaligi and Dorabella, sisters.
The soprano and mezzo-soprano.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, they always play off each other in opera like that. There's always a tenor hero and a baritone.
It's totally predictable. Yeah, typically the tenor is the hero, the soprano is the heroine, and the baritone or the bass is the bad guy. That actually is switched around, interestingly enough, in T, A Mirror of Soul, because the baritone is the hero, as it turns out, and the prince is the tenor, who is the bad guy. So sometimes maybe it changes a little bit. So here we have these two girls who are, they're moping, I suppose, over these beautiful portraits of their lovers. They're saying what wonderful young men they are and how completely happy they're going to be. And it raises the question, what are they in love with? Are they in love with the idea of love, with their portraits or with the men? I mean, is it clear? They do everything in harmony. They sing in thirds and sixths. They're totally symmetrical. This is a very classical piece in that symmetry rules the day at the beginning. Everything is in its place. Everything is predictable. These are politically correct marriages, and it's all going to be lovely, and nothing will darken their days. So this is the introduction, how we meet them, and then they find out that the boys are going to war, and this tragic farewell scene, and they come back to the house in tears, threatening to kill themselves, and we meet Despina. Despina is their maid. She's a wonderful, one of Mozart's great characters. Susanna in The Marriage of Figaro is another maid servant who really runs the show. Streetwise, knows exactly what's been going on. She's been around. She gives them advice on men. And her attitude is, what are you in tears for? They're soldiers. They'll have a girlfriend the minute they can, and you shouldn't be in tears. I mean, two can play that game. So in a way, this is the tit-for-tat aspect of the plot. If men can act like that, so can women. Why not? So that Mozart does give fair time to the girls in this. She says, "Let me see, I'm going to play you a little of her aria here." She sings, "Di pasta simili sono tutti quanti. Men are like pasta in all their varieties. Leaves ever fluttering, breezes in motion, waver no more than the heart of a man. Tears of the crocodile, simpering faces, second-hand rhapsodies, crafty embraces, are from the beginning part of their plan. What are women for? Only for pleasure. Men are amused with them just at their leisure, frown on or favour them quite as they please. Will you be trampled on, ladies, and bear it? This be your motto, then, up and declare it. Flout them and jilt them whenever you can." So this is her philosophy. And let's hear Cecilia Bartoli.
And there's a real sort of class issue going on with this maid who's very earthy and very streetwise, and these sort of, what would you call them, hothouse flowers of fiancés in their pretty little dresses, sort of naively.
And simpering, yes, exactly. And right. She's the one who keeps them in line. At the very opening scene, she's making chocolate for them, and it's their chocolate, and she's dying to taste it.
And but, she does taste it.
Yeah, so let's hear Cecilia Bartoli.
Ci rispreciano, negaci affetto, ne val da barbari chiedi.
And that was Cecilio Bartoli, the great Cecilio Bartoli, singing Despina from Così fan tutte. So just to give a very brief outline of this rather nonsensical little story, no sooner has Don Alfonso told the girls that the officers have gone than these two Albanians show up in exotic, ridiculous costumes. And they come in and they tell the girls that they're in love with them, and the girls instantly dismiss them. And there's no way they want anything to do with these two strangers, and show them the door. And Despina's saying, well, why? I mean, you know, flirt a bit.
Meanwhile, Despina's been paid off.
Yeah, that's right. Don Alfonso has come to her and said, you know, will you help me? He doesn't actually go as far as telling her that the officers are going to be the new lovers. He doesn't let her in on that. In fact, at the end of the opera, she too is made a fool of. In fact, she says, make sure in making fool of others, someone else does not make a fool of you. There's a very great line there of hers. So these two come in and they're shown the door, and they come back and they say they've taken poison because they're being rejected by the two girls, and it's all very theatrical and a parody, and they fall to the ground dying of poison. Now this puts the girls in a spot.
You know, now the two guys are their own fiancés in disguise. So one of the artifices of the opera is that they don't even recognize their own fiancés.
That's right, yeah. This is opera. You can do that. With the convention of opera, no. Even Despina, who's supposedly so smart, doesn't realize that the two new men are in fact the two officers. So,
and another artifice is that the whole entire action happens on one day.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Well, that fitting in with, again, the Greek model of theater should happen in a 24-hour time span.
Right.
And that's pushing it with this story, but it does. So they take the poison, they're dying, and the girls now are in a bit of a fix. What do we do? They're women, after all. They're not going to stand by and see these men die. Should they help? Should they run for help? And this is all reflected in the music. The music is switching from key to key to key. Which key should we be in here musically? How are we going to resolve it? And then the doctor appears. Now, this is another convention of the 18th century. It's Despina. She comes back dressed as Dr. Anton Mesmer. This is the famous Anton Mesmer, who is the father of hypnotism, who lived at the time in Vienna, and Mozart's having fun a little at his expense. He comes in with his magnet, and he goes up and down the boys' bodies with the magnets, sorting out their, balancing their key, if you like. Very Santa Fe.
It is very Santa Fe.
Gets rid of their negative essences.
Through magnets.
Exactly. And they begin to come round, and they come to, and they say, the only thing we need now to get better is a kiss. And the girls are still a little incensed, and they show them the door again. And the first act ends. Now, the boys are delighted because the girls clearly are being faithful and there's no sense of anything going on here.
But so not only are their fiancés faithful, but they're winning their bet.
Yes, they're winning the bet. So by the second act, Despina really gets to them. And now there's been a little time in reality from the time the soldiers have gone, and the girls are beginning to think, well, we're a bit bored. It wouldn't hurt to be polite to them. And they come back, and Don Alfonso and Despina sort of choreograph the two men towards the two girls who are not their fiancés. And they flirt, and each one takes a different approach. And ultimately, Dorabella succumbs first. It doesn't take long. She falls in love with a handsome stranger. Fiordaligi, it's a little harder for her. She really struggles with her conscience. Now, these two women at this point...
But she still falls by the end of the first day.
Oh, she does, yes, yeah. But the character development that Mozart does is quite wonderful here. In the beginning, they're two parts of a whole. They sing together in harmony. Everything they do, they're sisters, you know, joined at the hip. Now things change. Once the social game has changed, the rules have changed, they're not quite sure how to behave, so they behave differently. Dorabella, it turns out, falls over easily. It's not hard for her. She falls in love with the romanticism of it all. Whereas Fiordaligi is a woman of reason, and she fights this. She has a conscience. She says, I need to go to the front and to be with Guglielmo. I should shouldn't be here and I want nothing to do with these men, but she is attracted. Finally, Ferrando does have her succumb in an absolutely gorgeous aria that most women would fall for. I certainly would, regardless of who it was.
We must also say that these men are incredibly manipulative in their different ways of trying to get these
women
to succumb.
All three of them. Exactly, yeah. I mean, the whole... Mozart called this opera was one of three of a series called School for Love. There were lessons in love, in the game of love, Don Giovanni, The Marriage of Figaro, and this one. And the whole premise of this is based on lies and deceit and charade, if you think about it, you know. But maybe life is a little bit like that, too. I mean, how true and honest are we in relationships, especially when we first meet people?
How little has changed.
Yeah, exactly. How much do we pretend to be something we're not? And when the chips are down and when we're a little at sea about how to behave or how to perform or how we feel, especially if we fall for someone we probably should not fall for, then we're a little at sea and maybe then the true feelings come out. And that's happening here. Finally, however, Fiordaligi falls, and they decide there's going to be a wedding, an instant wedding. The two girls are going to marry the two Albanians who are not their fiancés. So the whole thing is set up, and the wedding is prepared, and again, Despina comes back in disguise as the notary. This audience loved disguise, and she comes back, and she sings in this ridiculous voice. She's going to marry the two couples, and the girls have just signed the wedding papers when the military march is heard off stage, and they know the soldiers are returning. The officers are coming back. So there's consternation. They rush the boys off and they're thunderstruck. What are they going to do? And 2 minutes later, the officers come back and are...
They've changed out of their Albanian costumes and back into their military
exactly,
costumes.
Exactly. And they come back and they're absolutely appalled to learn that both of the girls have succumbed. They are going to marry other people. At that point, Don Alfonso comes forward and he says that there's nothing to do and they'll have to kiss and make up, more or less. And let's forget it. It's been a little exercise and no harm's done. But actually, a lot of harm is done. They can't go back to where they were. There's a loss of innocence here. Even Despina, who thought she knew it all, realizes that she too has been fooled. So it's an enigmatic ending, and maybe we can talk about that a little down the road.
It's an enigmatic ending, but in a way, it's accepting of the lack of virtue as a human thing, and we can all fall in love and get married anyway.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. How did you see the ending? You saw the video.
Well,
Or how did you think the ending should be? Should they go back to their first fiancés, or should they stay with the new ones?
The fiancés who... The couples who were originally there and who loved their fiancés, they really still did love each other, and that's who they married. I mean,
And that was the 18th century response, that you would, there was no question, they would go back and marry the original coupling would remain.
In the 1960s or 70s they did the wife swapping ending?
That's always left up in the air. Mozart, I think, indicates that he wanted them to go back to the original partners because he starts this opera in C major and the whole thing ends in C major. There is a complete design here and it's a sort of a musical clue. But in the 60s, in our present day, I mean, you can argue that maybe the first partners was just marriages of convenience. They weren't truly in love. They hadn't been tested. And now they've been tested and found out their hearts lay somewhere else. So maybe they should be with the new partners.
But there are a number of scenes where the two men talk about how much they truly love and adore their wives, even after they've been fiancés, even after they've been unfaithful.
Yeah. It's usually to do with the girls, which where are they going to go? Because the men do, I agree, tend to want to be with their original partners. Now, the way many this is Mozart left it wide open, so directors from succeeding generations from the 1790 to today have a lot of fun or play with this. There's all sorts of different endings you can have, and typically, though, I'm not sure how it's going to be done in this production at Santa Fe, but very often they'll have the four principals, the two boys and the two girls, sing together, but not to one another. So it's impossible to tell who is singing to whom when they are all, you know, when they resolve the story at the end. It's left up in the air.
And you thought opera was intellectual and highbrow.
It's fun, you know, this one. In fact, most of the operas this season are really fun. There's no true drama, perhaps, except for maybe the death of Lan in Tea. So, and the death of Mimi. I mean, there's a real tearjerker in La Boheme. Bring tissues to that one. You know, no matter how often I play that opera, and especially when I have to excerpt and take pieces out, and I play that ending, I still have a hard time getting through it. When I tell people about it, it's hard. Puccini has a way, I think, in his music of manipulating you. It's a good word. You know, and that whole thing that we talked about last week of in the Baroque opera, of being able to evoke an emotional response from your audience, that's planned because of the music that you're doing. Puccini does it with silence. Just before they all realize Mimi has died, there is silence, nothing. And we, the audience, know what's happened. We know that she's dead, but her friends, her lover, they don't know. And then when the music comes back in, it undoes you. So it's amazing. Maybe, and is manipulation bad? I don't know if I want to. If you cry at the death of Mimi, it means you know, you're a human being. It's great.
We're talking about Così fan tutte. And Desiree Mays is with us. She is the author of Opera Unveiled, which is the book that comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe opera season. We're going to take a little break right now. We will be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. We're back, and we're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, and today we're talking about Così fan tutte, the opera by Mozart. So this opera was, the music was written by Mozart, the libretto was written by Lorenzo da Ponte.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about him and their collaboration.
Well, he was a very colorful character. He had an amazing career, was a minister of the church at one point. I mean, he was totally promiscuous and was quite well in with the Emperor Joseph, though actually when the Emperor Joseph died, as he did shortly after the premiere of Così fan tutte, this opera only had a few performances in Vienna, sadly, before the Emperor died, and then they closed all the theaters. So it sort of had a difficult start in life. With the succeeding emperor, Lorenzo da Ponte, was totally out of favor, and he was virtually shown the door and asked to leave Vienna, which he did. He came to America, actually, and he became a professor at Columbia, and he's actually buried in New York.
Wow.
Which is amazing. But he and Mozart collaborated. This was one of the few truly great collaborations between a librettist and a composer, Lorenzo da Ponte and Mozart. They balanced one another very well. Of the two voices in this particular opera, I think Lorenzo da Ponte is a little skeptical. After all, he did have this girlfriend, La Ferrarese, who is rumored to have been involved in a wife-swapping incident, and is skeptical. If you read the libretto, and it's good to read this libretto ahead of time, it gives you one fear for the opera, is that he is on the side of the men. I mean, he's skeptical about women's behavior, but he had a lot of experience in that department. Whereas Mozart, as I said, is very compassionate and very empathetic to the women.
That brings out a very interesting concept that the music might be a little bit more favorable to one side and the libretto to the other.
It is. You listen to this music and there's no question. I mean, at some points, depending again how it's presented, it can be a parody of Mozart can be parodying himself or opera or the situation. But a lot of it is straight from the heart. This next, maybe we should play the next aria, the tenor aria, Un Auro Amoroso. A beautiful moment from the tenor here is Waldemar Kmet. This is sung by Ferrando when he sings of love, and I think this is an aria that comes straight from the heart. There's no manipulation, no game playing here. It's just a hymn to love. Un dolce tesoro And that was the tenor aria, Un'aura amoroso, from Così Van Tutte, which the Santa Fe Opera will be presenting this summer.
And we could talk for another two or three programs about the themes that are brought up in Così Fan Tutte, but let's talk about the Santa Fe Opera itself.
Mm-hmm.
This is a major organization. It's local, it's national, it's international, it's
interplanetary. Yes, that would be nice. But it has an international reputation. I travel a lot in the rest of the year, and the Santa Fe Festival in New Mexico is talked about all over the world, and people love coming here. They come in droves. I mean, we had mainly an international audience. Now, this opera company is working hard to work with New Mexico. So there's all sorts of programs to bring in people from here. And there's a wonderful mix of people now that you see at the opera, which is great. It's a very big organization. In fact, I think next to state government, the Santa Fe Opera employs the most people in June, July, and August. There's about 600 people involved in productions. They do five productions. There's a full symphony orchestra, the singers, the costumers, people who are working year-round who prepare costumes and sets. We have two apprentice programs for singers where we bring them in and they're learning their trade and they sing in the operas. And there are also technicians who come in and work to learn the business of theater from the ground up with the greatest teachers. It's a really family sort of event. That's the feeling I always get when I go up there in rehearsals. The place is filled with music. I mean, they're rehearsing two or three operas at a time in different studios all over these gorgeous grounds. And then at the cantina, which is part of the old ranch house that John Crosby bought many years ago, over 50 years now, where everybody assembles and they have meals. So these singers, international singers and directors, musicians from all over the world, mix and meet. And it's like one big family. It's really great during the rehearsal weeks. So it's a big number of people, over 600. The budget is about $15.5 million this year, so it's a big budget. It's a lot of planning.
One thing that I find interesting is there's one orchestra that plays all the operas, but there are not only different directors, but different conductors.
Yes, that's right. Each opera has its own sort of production team. It has its own director, singers, of course, and conductor. The orchestra, clearly we don't have a full-time Santa Fe Opera Orchestra, but they are performers who come in year after year after year. Many of them are in the great orchestras of this country, and they're on holiday in the summer. So these great musicians will come here for the 3 months to play for our operas and then go back to their normal symphonies. So the standard of musicianship is very high. play. And it's interesting the reaction of the players to each conductor, because conductors come in all shapes, forms, and sizes and make all sorts of demands. And an orchestra can make or break a conductor sometimes. If they really do not like or respect a conductor, they really do not perform for him. I mean, this is a very touchy point. If it's a great conductor or someone who is new to a role or someone who's done it many times but who's prepared to take time with them, it's a very fine line. But when an orchestra respects a conductor, the impossible can be achieved and often is.
And, I mean, we must add that the musicians in the orchestra come back year after year after year, mm-hmm. and the conductors are specific to that one summer, that one opera.
That's right, though Kenneth Montgomery is coming back for the 25th year now.
Is that right?
So we have some conductors who are here who've been here many years, and others who are being given maybe a start here. Alan Gilbert came here as a music director a few years ago when he was well thought of, but his career suddenly took off. This man is in demand in every orchestra and opera house you name, and he is chosen to go that route. This is what he will do with his career. So Santa Fe launched him in a sense to fame, but of course it means we've lost our music director, and there will be another one.
So you have a music director who's the music director of the whole opera, and then you have specific directors for each individual opera. How do they work together?
Richard Gallas heads all of this. He's the executive director, and the ultimate decisions lie with him. And there are department heads for every conceivable department in the opera, and there are many, many of them. He, with Brad Woolbright, who works with him, they get together, and also with the board, because budget, of course, is part of this. There's a board of people who come from all over this country who come to help with the business end of an opera company. They look at the budget and see where it is, and then they decide what operas they are going to do for the next two or three years out. This is planning way, way in advance for many reasons, for budget, for singer availability. If you want a certain singer in a certain role, they may be booked for 3 years, so it's tricky. It's a team effort. It's quite impressive how this does fall into place, and it means many, many people, but ultimately the decisions are made by Richard Gallas, who actually has done an incredible job, I think, since he has taken over the reins of the Santa Fe Opera, in choosing repertoire, because that can make or break a company. If the repertoire is not right, if the audiences don't like it, if they don't like the singers or what's being presented, this is not good. And these seasons have been phenomenally successful.
People come from all over the world.
They come from all over the world. And then the way it works is one opera is presented a week. So in July, the first opera will come up. Bohème will be the first one, the opening opera. Così Van Tutte, which we're talking about today, is going to open in 4 or 5 days. On Saturday will be the first night of Così, and then the next opera the following week will be Daphne, until all five are up. And this, again, is an extraordinary feat. When the five operas are ready for performance, there is one a night. So in August, people can come and get all five operas on consecutive nights, which means the stage crews are working, I promise you, day and night, because they strike one show at 1 o'clock in the morning, which is typically when the operas end, and then they set up the next one for the following day. But in August, that's the busiest time, because people can come and do. I mean, they come not just for one or two operas. Most of the groups that I talk to who come in from all over go to all five operas one after another. So it's an extraordinary, it's a split-second timing from right from the get-go to what you see on stage. Most people have no idea what goes on, the amount of work and collaboration. But if you go to any of those parties that end the season, that's one great, wonderful family. And contacts are made here, and people become, and marriages are made here. Last year, Joyce DiDonato skipped, she was Cinderella. She skipped the Santa Fe Opera for a little while, went to Las Vegas and married her conductor in Las Vegas, came back and sang Cinderella a couple of nights later.
Let's hope that nobody tested their fidelity beforehand.
Or since, I hope. So it's an amazing art form, because it includes so much. It's singing, it's music, it's drama, it's art in the costume, set design. You talk to the lighting director, every nuance of feeling is reflected in the light, on the costumes, on the faces, in the sets. The set design, when we did Ina de Mar here a couple of years ago, Gronk came. He was a street artist, a graffiti artist at one point, and here he is painting this incredible set that's vibrant and living. So there's art here. So there's so many.
Well, Tan Dun, the composer, he played on the street.
That's right. When he got to Colombia, he had money to go to college, but not much to live on. So he was a street player. Should I tell you his little story?
Yeah.
This is a true story. This is the composer who premiered The First Emperor, the great production of the Metropolitan Opera in December. And he's in the subway going to the Met to work. And he meets an old friend of his who used to play in the streets with him. They had no money and they were street players. So the friend said, "How are you doing, Tan?" He said, "I'm doing fine." So the friend said, "Where are you playing these days? You're still at Lincoln Center and he said, "Yes, indoors."
There we have it.
That's it. So
we have enough time for one more selection from Così fan tutte.
I'd like to play another track by Cecilio Bartoli. This is the Come Scoglio, where Fiordaligi says, "I'm firm like a fortress. My heart will not be assailed by any man." And this is a really challenging aria, and she handles it quite beautifully. So let's hear Come Scoglio from Cecilio Bartoli.
Così fan tutte by Mozart, and that is one of the five operas in the Santa Fe opera season. Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us here.
It's been great, Mary Charlotte. Thank you so much for sharing five whole of Radio Cafe shows with me and the opera, and I hope everybody will come up the hill and see one, two, three, four, or five of these operas this summer.
And you can find out more about it at santafeopera.org. And you are also going to be giving lectures.
Yes, every night I lecture at the Preview Buffet and tell people a story, give them a little background, and prepare you for the opera.
All that and much, much more at the Santa Fe Opera. Check it out. It's really been wonderful to hear your wisdom and to read your book, Opera Unveiled, which is available at the Santa Fe Opera and at many of the local bookstores right here in Santa Fe. Thanks so much, Desiree.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web live at ksfr.org. And this show is podcasting. You can find us at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Thank you.